Hey Ryan, you know why I could never go on the lam?
Why?
Because home is where I get my spark plug coffee delivered, and I've been too spoiled by delicious fresh roasted coffee.
That's a good reason.
It's a good reason. I could never go back to mediocre coffee again. Spark plug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded.
Fairly.
And they offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half calf, and a rotating blend for those of you with adventurous tastes.
Rotating.
But the best part is that Spark Plug delivers this delicious coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor.
Peak.
And I promise, you will taste the difference. Spark Plug even offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again.
Autopilot.
It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So, plug yourself in at ryansparkplugcoffee.com.
It's a cinch.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Welcome to the podcast, everybody. I'm much obliged for downloading the Next 100 Project. We review random classic movies because our original quest to talk about all the AFI Top 100 movies was achieved a ways back. Hear me now when I warn you that we spoil motion pictures, and that's a cinch. I'm the guy who doesn't kill entire families, Ryan Ellis, and here with me yet again is my wife, who I hope has equal disdain for mass murder, Bev.
That's me.
Bev, you should disdain all forms of mass murder. Solo murder, we'll talk. All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture in Cold Blood. What version of Robert Blake frightens you the most? As Perry in Cold Blood, as the mystery man in Lost Highway, or as a real-life Mur-diddly-urdler?
Silly question, because obviously it's the mystery man, one of the scariest characters ever put on film. I would face the real Robert Blake any day before I would be in a room with a mystery man.
The real guy has a gun, according to the story. But I guess he didn't actually kill his wife because he's still roaming free. Trying to get work, actually. I was reading that recently. Still trying to get work, but who's going to hire the guy? It's funny, too, because his character in Cold Blood is based on a real person. Then the mystery man thing is obviously very much fantasy. But then the real life guy became a tabloid deal. So real fantasy tabloid. My choice? Probably the real guy as a Mur-diddly-urdler.
Liar. You are scared of the mystery man, too. Come on.
There's a great shot in Lost Highway. Dude, I'm holding a camera. Just holding that video camera. That's a great shot. Lynch. David Lynch comes up with incredible scary moments.
David Lynch, who comes up with incredibly scary moments, I don't think has ever made anything creepier than Mystery Man. And I...
Mulholland Drive. Bum behind the diner.
Of being terrified of Bob. Oh, yeah, you're right. The diner. Oh, my God.
And Bob. Twin Peaks. Anyway. The Next 100 Project 72nd movie. 72 movies now we've been doing since the Top 100 Project ended. We're almost 100. Well, we're getting there anyway. In Cold Blood was nominated for the 1998 AFI Top 100 list, but didn't get nominated in 2007. Huh. Wonder why. Columbia Pictures released In Cold Blood in time for Oscar consideration in December 1967, a landmark year. And the movie was a success. Bev, tell people what that success is about with your skinny.
Robert Blake is Perry, and Scott Wilson plays Dick. Two prison buddies who follow a spurious tip to rob a family of farmers in their home late one night. The robbery ends in tragedy when Perry and Dick murder all four members of the innocent family, determined to leave no witnesses. Then they go on the lam, where their wits and friendship are tested until justice finally catches up with them.
Or, in a nutshell, senseless slaughter, rural region rocked, killers condemned, next noosed, adieu, idiots.
They are idiots.
They're quite the idiots.
Yeah, the movie doesn't mince its portrayal of them as just plain dumb, like making one dumb decision after another.
They really are. Okay, some Rotten Tomatoes numbers. First, 91% of critics liked the movie, 30 fresh, 3 rotten, and 88% of audiences, so damn good scores. And in that landmark year of 1967, I just mentioned, it was 21st at the box office. The Graduate was the smash hit of 1967. And such a monumental year it was because we had four AFI films, plus In Cold Blood, plus Cool Hand Luke. Those probably both should have made it. Well, certainly Cool Hand Luke, I think, should have. And then movies in general, Hollywood, changing in big ways. And movies like this were an example of that. It's an anti-capital punishment picture, especially in the final 20 minutes, and it's based on the true crime of the poor Clutter family who were blown away in their own home in Holcomb, Kansas in November 1959, and Truman Capote, of course, wrote the true crime book based on this. What did you think of In Cold Blood, your second viewing?
Yeah, I love this movie. I was all for it when you suggested doing it. It's snappy, it's entertaining, the acting is incredible, and it's really thought-provoking. I'm bothered that in 67, when, as you say, Hollywood was changing, people have given more credit to The Graduate than movies like this that I think pushed the envelope more and perhaps were more, like, ultimately influential.
Guess Who's Coming to Dinner was also that year an AFI film, and so was In the Heat of the Night on the second list, and so was, what was it? Bonnie and Clyde, of course.
Oh, and of course, Bonnie and Clyde, no contest. Of all those 67 movies we've named, is the best.
The other two were race relations films, and that was important, although I don't think either of them are perfect or even maybe great. Good, maybe not great. This one probably borders on greatness, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess it's the poor man's Bonnie and Clyde. It covers similar themes, and it challenges the audience in almost exactly the same way, where they present people who are very much bad people, but they tell their story in a way that makes you both empathize with them and have contempt for their actions. You leave the movie feeling very conflicted in a great way.
You should be conflicted at the very end because you spend most of the movie with the two killers. We don't see the murder until towards the end, though. I love the structure. I'm assuming, and I think that's in the book by Truman Capote, that you find out how they killed the family later on. But because we're with them for so much of the film, we have to identify with them. It's the thing I've talked about in other podcasts. It's the Godfather, Goodfellas, Pulp Fiction syndrome, where you spend so much time with the bad guys, Taxi Driver's another one you got to include in that one, that if you don't sympathize with them or empathize with them in some kind of way, then you might as well just turn it off and stop watching.
I say Taxi Driver is more of a cousin to In Cold Blood, but when you talk about movies like The Godfather and Goodfellas, those are movies where I think you're really meant to side with the bad guys.
As if they're the good guys, really.
As if they're the good guys. Yeah, like, you're so really supposed to be on their side. But, you know, you say it's an anti-capital punishment movie. I'm against the death penalty, but if there's anybody in the world that deserves the death penalty, if there's any perfect argument for the death penalty, then it's a crime like the Clutter Family Massacre.
Yeah, that's true. But the thing I object to, and Dead Man Walking did this so well, the Tim Robbins movie, it's planned murder by those who know better. They're not idiots, meaning the government. Well, the government can be idiots, but when you've got that many people in charge of things, that many people with a say in things, including a jury and a judge, obviously at some point in the whole procedure, and cops, and everybody else has to go through this whole thing, and governors can always grant a stay of execution. The system worked, but it doesn't really work in a good way. And the guy playing the Truman Capote character in this movie, Jensen, Paul Stewart, who is the butler in Citizen Kane, he does talk about it a little bit, what I'm saying now, I think, which is, that doesn't seem right. These awful people should be punished. And you're right. If anybody's going to be killed, people like this should be killed, especially Perry, because he's the one who commits all the murders. Dick is there, but he's not actually kill anybody.
Which is funny, because the film kind of portrays him as the worst
of
the two characters. You were strongly given the impression that as much as Perry is a flawed man, if he had had different influences in his life, he very well could have turned out to be a good person. Whereas Dick just seems like straight out a selfish, bad, short-sighted.
Perry is usually nice in the whole movie, and he wants to bail on the job the night they arrive at the farm. Let's get out of here. But he is the one who kills everybody. It's a great dichotomy. And because it's based on reality, they have to go with what actually happened. But even if this was a fictional story, I would have loved that idea. The guy who's driving the story all the way through, Dick, is not the one who does the ultimate wrong thing.
It's what makes the story so compelling in the first place. It's why Truman Capote became obsessed with it for years and years of his life, and why the book that he wrote became one of the biggest classics in true crime nonfiction in the world, in history.
It's called The Birth of the Nonfiction Novel.
Yeah, it's a disputed title, but it certainly is the first very popular nonfiction novel, and still a classic, still one of the best.
Did you read it?
No, I've never read it, but a good friend of ours, Jill, has read it, and I was talking to her about it today. She said she loved it, you know, and the story's incredible.
Okay. One big thing that's not in the movie but is in the book is it said they never planned to leave witnesses, so 'twas always a killing. Even though the movie presents it as they didn't have to and they weren't necessarily going to, but they did at the end. Although once they didn't wear masks, they had to kill them.
When they couldn't find stockings like they were looking for, Dick says, that's okay, we're not going to leave witnesses. They were planning all along to not leave witnesses. I disagree with what you say because they stated several times before they actually commit the crime.
The way Perry plays it, though, it's not that they're going to kill them. It's that they're going to just take what they want and go.
But the way Perry's portrayed is that he's kind of this magical thinker who mm-hmm. doesn't really expect things to happen the way he fantasized about them, perhaps, or his fantasies are just so outlandish that once he's actually faced with something that he's been imagining, he panics. And this is exactly what he said. He's like, I imagine this coming all the way up here, and now that we're here and it's actually going to happen, I want out. It was just a fun thing to think about, like trying to find Cortez's gold. It's a fun thing to think about and maybe go through the motions of how you're going to make that happen. But the fact is, he just enjoys fantasizing about it. And he had no intention, really, of carrying out the crime had Dick not pushed him into it.
And they show his tough father in not quite flash frames. It's pretty clear that he's visualizing this guy. Maybe that's the gasoline on his fire to actually go through with it and kill the very nice man, as he says in the car towards the end of the movie when he admits what he did. I thought he was a very nice gentleman right up before I shot him. Or was it slit his throat before I slit his throat?
Such a great line, which was in the book as well, that line. Mm-hmm. I like the character of his father. It's a really interesting scene. His father kind of shares Perry's magical thinking, as I said. You know, he's so sure he raised a good kid. He's so confident that his lessons were imparted that he just can't see what's right in front of him, that his son is a criminal. Just got out of prison and just committed an incredibly gruesome set of murders.
Yeah, Perry commits parole violation before the movie even really gets going, because once he leaves, where was he again? But he goes to Kansas to do this act. Right there, he belongs in jail because he's violating his parole. And Charles McGraw, who is Perry's dad, was in Spartacus. I don't remember what the role was, but he was in that. And The Birds. And he reminded me a lot of the Dennis Hopper character. And this movie came many years later, True Romance. In that case, it's bad guys. But in this case, it's cops. Talk to the dad. And you get all kinds of information about maybe where this guy came from. In this case, it's a more important influence than Hopper is on Christian Slater's character in True Romance.
Mm-hmm. The movie is trying to delve into all the Freudian aspects of this crime. It's definitely suggesting that there was a lot of nurture rather than nature going into Perry's way. They don't really delve into Dick so much, but as far as Perry's actions go, they are blaming his drunk mother and his unconventional prospector father, who, for all the nice things he says about his boy, chased him out of the home with a rifle, right? Threatened to kill him.
Yeah, that's what he sees in his mind's eye before he kills Mr. Clutter, is that moment. The Robert Blake character in the movie, Perry, and Robert Blake, had the same tough upbringing. This guy, maybe he would blame what's happened in his life on that, too. I don't know if Robert Blake was a war veteran, but Perry is, and that's another excuse, maybe, for what he goes through in this movie.
Did you catch that while everybody credits his limp to a war injury in Korea, he's a pretty pronounced limp, and they're like, oh, no, he's a war hero.
And his legs are on fire all the time.
Yeah, but then they also show a motorcycle accident, and I wonder if they're suggesting that his injury actually came from the motorcycle accident.
Well, so he's a liar, then, on top of everything else.
Well, liar, I mean, he never says it himself. He just doesn't correct anybody when they say that it's a war injury. Because they show the motorcycle accident and then directly cut. The editing's amazing in this movie, and there's lots of really great suggestive cuts. What shot from the end of one scene leads into the first shot of the next scene. There's lots of information conveyed in that, and one of them is cutting straight from his motorcycle accident to the image of his legs with all of the scars.
And is he not chewing his aspirin, which reminds me of the book version of The Shining, where Jack, instead of drinking, chews his aspirin? Of course, that would have been Stephen King being influenced by this book and movie. Or maybe the movie. I don't know if that actually happened in reality. I probably should have read the In Cold Blood book.
If you chew aspirin, it works faster. Mm-hmm. Any drug, if you grind it up,
which is kind of an addiction.
I guess so. It's aspirin.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of the movie was shot in the real locations in Kansas, including the Clutter House.
That's
which is
crazy.
Kind of eerie and weird. And only a few years later, another example of a book to movie thing that only happened, well, in this case, 1 year later. Truman Capote's book came out in 1966. You mentioned he wrote it for years because the murder happened in 1959, but the book comes out in 66, the movie comes out in 67, and by the way, the title of the movie is one of those where it's Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, so
well,
credit to Richard.
Well, the book's a huge hit, it was a sensation.
Yeah, right, sure, kind of like The Godfather was Mario Puzo's The Godfather, I guess, because Francis Ford Coppola knew you got to take advantage of the fact that the author had written this bestseller. But Richard Brooks deserves credit for, and maybe the studio, but somebody deserves credit for saying this is his story as much as anyone else's. And this is the kind of a murder that ruins an entire town's innocence, especially a small place like Holcomb.
The murder sequence itself is tremendously effective. The Clutters are just so genuinely innocent. They are a believable family. And that focus on Nancy's face
too
when he's
perfect, though.
Okay, you mean you see like a snapshot of their lives. At the very least, they seem very real. Perhaps a little
very ordinary, too. And
very,
I kind of like that.
Yeah. I can see why that crime captured the attention of the nation, because that is exactly all of our worst fears, that a completely random stranger will break into our homes and murder us and murder our children. Is there anything that could be more terrifying than this crime? So then the most impactful thing the film does is force the audience to sit with the contradictions of that fear and that contempt, plus the pity that you feel for Perry.
Perry more so than for Dick. The home invasion thing, a lot of movies have done this, of course. The Strangers is one of the best examples. I just thought right now of A Clockwork Orange. Of course, that's also a book, too. Even The Purge. And in all cases, I would say realistic home invasion scenarios.
Yeah, and they treat the murder with this astonishing cruelty. The scene near the end where Dick is illustrating to Perry how they're going to choke whoever picks him up when they're hitchhiking, and he's got his belt and he's snapping it, like, what you do is put it around his neck and you choke him till he's dead, and then we take all his stuff. That's what ends up happening to Perry and Dick. They both are hung by the neck. That's how they die. When they're depicting the murders in all of its brutality and, again, I'll say it, the cruelty of it.
But because it's
so
1967, we didn't see blood and guts.
You don't have to.
You don't.
You have to see the performances of the actors who see it coming. One of the most amazing things the film does is that you really do spend that 2 hours contemplating what it must be like to know that your life is going to end any moment. And you do that both as the Clutters and then again when they're waiting for their own execution. The movie strongly implies that Perry's version of the story is the truth, since it's his confession that prompts a flashback for us to see what happened. So there's no reason to doubt his version of the story, since it's so incredibly unflattering.
We are now in the dog days of August, and if you do hear some dog panting, that would explain why. Maybe we'll start panting, because it is a hot room here.
We've already begun sweating.
Already? We started sweating the second we got in this room.
For the second time, I'm going to compliment the editing of the film, because they made a choice to wait until near the end of the film to depict the murders, which I think is a choice Capote also made, where he saved all the gore for the end of the book. While that's to titillate us and to make us wait for the main event, it also serves to give the movie time to make us care about Perry and get invested in him. But then by the time they show the crime, it is anything but sugar-coated. And it's so jarring to watch a sympathetic character commit butchery. And it's not just any crime, it's each of our worst fears. So it sets us up to root for Perry and just pulls the rug right out from under us. At the end, when Perry's afraid of his own execution, it's hard to feel sorry for it.
Well, as for when they do kill the Clutters, of course the phrase is senseless slaughter, which I used earlier in the nutshell. Can somebody tell me which slaughter ever made sense?
Well, a slaughter could make sense if your life is threatened.
Well, that wouldn't be a slaughter, it'd be a murder of self-defense.
Well, slaughter could make sense.
A self-defense slaughter.
If you...
Sensible self-defense slaughter. All S's except
if
for
if you're,
defense.
Like, slaughtering livestock... Then that
well,
makes
we're talking
sense.
About people, though, here.
Okay, yeah, fine. There's no senseful slaughter.
It's one of those cliches I had to bring up. There's a lot of cliches in this movie, or at least lines and interesting phrases, for sure. The cinch thing, we heard this back in the day a lot, the word, it's a cinch, they say this many times in the movie. This may not be so cliche, but it's an interesting opening with dialogue, at least, to what these guys are all about. Early on, Perry gets the letter from Dick, and it's, "Love, Dick." And I don't think that's a problem. I think that's fine. You say love Dick, but this movie has suggestive dialogue in the early going that the guys are maybe borderline gay. Now, that's also something written by a gay guy, Truman Capote, but they say honey and baby to each other. Maybe it's more Dick to Perry. But that's said fairly often, especially in the early going of the movie.
Maybe the suggestion is that Perry's gay and Dick is kind of taking advantage of that to help manipulate him.
Ooh, you know what? We were talking about Glengarry Glen Ross last week in the Movies We Hated podcast. And one thing you didn't get into, or I didn't really debate you on too much when you mentioned the Pacino character, but why he's got Jonathan Pryce on the hook for property is that he knows Jonathan Pryce is a closet homosexual and he's playing off of that. He even says to Jack Lemmon at one point, "I do this thing with my hair." And the whole idea being he's playing on the fact that this other guy is not out of the closet, but he's gay. Well, maybe that's what's going on here. Two, Dick knows that Perry is gay, so he's going to call him things like honey and baby and draw him in even more.
I mean, a closet homosexual in the 50s or even in the 80s, that would be a hard life. That would be a lonely life. So, yeah, you probably would be that much easier to manipulate.
And Perry probably pushed a lot of people away, so if Dick is going to accept him at all, that's why he sticks with him. Why does he stick with this guy? Well, that may be the reason why, because at least this guy wants to stick with him.
Yeah, and Dick is portrayed as more or less a charismatic sociopath. He's totally untroubled by the crime, even goes as far as to call it a success, regardless of the fact that they only got away with $43, binoculars, and a radio. He never planned to leave any witnesses. He just had no compunction about killing this family. It was his plan all along. He's a classic, charming sociopath, and he uses his talents to manipulate Perry, but he also uses those talents to great effect, illustrated very well, to con shopkeepers when he's passing bad checks all over the place. A stupid move, to say the least, because it's why the cops knew that they were in town and knew how to, like, follow their actions. But he's a really skilled con man.
He should have been Frank Abagnale Jr. He's a great paper hanger.
Catch Me If You Can,
the Leo DiCaprio character in Catch Me If You Can. He's really good at that, actually, and he's charming in a way that we see it a little bit with Perry, but he's very charming with these people. He manipulates people very well. It's almost like he missed his calling. If you're going to be a criminal, be that criminal.
But like any sociopath, he lacks patience. He's impetuous. He doesn't have any thoughts about consequences of his actions. He's very short-sighted. His poor planning is what gets them caught, and he does everything wrong. He's an absolutely incompetent criminal, and he insists to Perry that they leave Mexico and go back to the States for right. No other reason than he's bored.
They got away clean, and then they go back to Kansas, and they're asking to get caught. Mexico back to Kansas is about a 14-hour drive, but it's actually further to go from Kansas to Vegas, where they actually do get caught. So they are driving about a day's worth just to get back to the Kansas area, and then even further to Vegas. Why? Because they're smart, but they're also dumb at the same time. It's a strange dichotomy. And Dick bases his "the clutters are rich" intel on hearsay from a fellow criminal. He wants the tale of richness to be real, even though he must see that it's not, even before they get there, and certainly once they get there, but still they're banging on the walls. Oh, there's got to be a safe here somewhere. Just because some criminal told you that was the case. But then both these guys are also dwelling on the past, and maybe that's part of it too, that we really can't understand these guys because they don't understand themselves. Dick's got booties hanging from his rearview mirror, which my mom has of my niece and nephew, or, well, one of them, I guess, but it must be the niece. She's older. But why does a grown man have that? My mother's a grandmother. The flashback sequences for Perry, of course, about when he was a kid, they're both dwelling in the past. They're holding on to hurt and then hurting.
And I wonder, because they're both from that same part of America, but they grew up rather poor, if there's a certain amount of resentment for the Clutter family, who were these prosperous farmers and had this nice, perfect, middle-class life.
Yeah, they may not have been rich in the usual way, but they were doing at least fine.
Yeah, they did just fine. He was a really well-respected, self-made man. They employed lots of people and did very well for themselves. Perhaps there was a bit of class resentment there. Not that the movie explores this, I'm just imagining what would have prompted Dick to target the Clutters so seriously. He had such a laser focus on the Clutters and no one else. Yeah.
In his mind, they deserve it, probably. Yeah. Because they have something he doesn't.
And because I don't think he feels any ways about taking a life, either.
But he doesn't even take a life, and I love that again. The dichotomy, the strange mix.
You can't write it. It really did happen. That's part of what's so compelling about this movie and this story. A couple of fudging moments here and there, and people have criticized Capote for massaging the details to make it more story-friendly. But for the most part, most of the details of this story are absolutely true.
A lot of movies have been based on true stories, or what they now will write is based on true events, but this is one of the more vivid ones of all time. Now, one of the more successful endeavors they ever have, and it is about making money, is when they're collecting empty bottles and cans. I guess more back in that era, but specifically bottles. But take it from a pro, doing that can be very lucrative. I did that when I was a youngster, collecting empty beer cans and bottles. And I made quite a bit of money doing it, especially for a kid.
Is there a moment in the film where you ever see Perry happier than when he's collecting
bottles? Exactly, that's why I bring it up.
Yeah.
Because they're doing that with the young kid and his grandfather, I guess it is. And they actually seem to be enjoying themselves in a way that's almost irrational. There's that sequence in The Wrestler, a movie you didn't like very much, where he is behind the deli and he's actually getting into it. It's one of my favorite moments in the whole film, where he enjoys himself for a little bit. he's calling people cutie and he's throwing, hey, go along with this tub of potato salad. So the wrestler and In Cold Blood have sequences like that that are very small, not important, but in some ways are very illuminating to the characters we care about the most.
And probably illuminating to the world view that a good, honest day's work is far more satisfying than that get-rich-quick scheme working out.
Mm-hmm. So when they're caught, Floyd Wells is the living witness who is maybe the main reason, if not the only reason, they actually do get caught, because he tells them that he knows who Dick is, so that leads the cops along to Perry and Dick. Although Perry and Dick are witnesses against each other, we saw something like that in LA Confidential, where Ed Exley very smartly plays one of the criminals off the other criminal. You know, this guy will sell you out. And then Perry and Dick do sell each other out. Oh, now, I'm not going to try to judge them too hard, because I don't know what I'd be like. I might fold them to questioning! As Tommy says in Goodfellas, and of course in Goodfellas, he does fold under questioning. But these two guys do sell each other out, and then they go on death row for 5 years before they're killed, which isn't really that long, according to my understanding of death row.
I think back in the 50s and 60s, it was longer than average.
Well, they did have an awful lot of appeals, and then denials, and then appeals, and so on, until finally that ran out, and then their next one snapped.
I think the court system is just way more backed up now than it was in the 50s and 60s. Another great editing moment is when they're in Vegas, and the cops come up to them, address them, and then there's a hard cut to them in prison. We don't see the scene where they're apprehended. We don't see that drama. The film doesn't waste time in what a lot of films would milk for drama, because they just want to stay focused on their theme of the conflict between caring for Perry and empathizing with him and facing the crime that he's committed.
I give kudos to the editing by Peter Zinner also, who cut the first two Godfather flicks and The Deer Hunter. So that guy's got a great resume, but he wasn't nominated for the editing for this movie, and as we're saying now, probably should have been.
I'm not going to win any points by comparing it to Bonnie and Clyde, which a lot of people acknowledge is one of the best edited films of all time, but I don't know, I kind of like this one better. I think it has a little more points for difficulty. You've got this triple narrative. You've got all this back and forth with the time. It comes and goes. It's intentionally disjointed and confusing.
Especially in the beginning, where we see the Clutters and the eventual killers. But they're still separate at that point. The Clutters in their daily life, and then Perry and Dick as they build to what they're going to do.
And they choose to make that hard cut between them arriving at the house and the bodies being discovered the next morning by people coming to pick them up to go to church, which was probably true. Another squeaky, clean detail about the Clutters.
So how about that haunting ending where first Dick and then especially Perry do get hanged by the neck? What did you think of the very end of the movie where it's, by the way, a great design choice with the sound, where it's the heartbeat sound effect? We've heard it in a lot of movies. It's been done many times. Sometimes you don't even notice it. We've pointed out in some of our podcasts when sound designers have chosen to use this, or the director chose to use it, whatever it may be. But you hear that thump, 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 thump of a heart. But in this case, it's there, and then it's faster, and then it goes dum, 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 and then that's it. And the movie just says the end, and it's over.
Is there a more harrowing thing to depict than somebody waiting to be executed? We talked about this when we did Paths of Glory, where the entire third act of the film is three men waiting to be executed. Some people fighting their case, but in the end, they just get walked to the firing squad and they're shot dead. And here we have Perry panicked, counting the minutes that he has left to live, trying to make sense of the last moments of his life. And it's so effective. As gutting as the murders in the Clutter House are, I don't think there's many deaths in cinema that compare with the moment that that trapdoor opens and his body falls through.
But before that is one of the more famous moments in the whole movie. Maybe the most famous shot in the whole movie.
Cinematography-wise, yeah, no doubt.
And a complete accident, because it's the tears and rain speech, if you will. He doesn't cry, but it's raining outside the set. Well, they, of course, have a water machine to do that. And then there's a fan blowing for an effect they wanted, and then that blew the water onto the window in such a way that it looks like Perry is actually crying. The way
because it's lit from behind, so the shadows of the water falling down the window land right on Perry's face.
As he's talking about his bad upbringing and why he's the killer he is. Conrad Hall admitted it wasn't exactly planned, it was a bit of a mistake. And Robert Altman said it, the best things in movies are mistakes. I don't think that's always true, but in this case, that might be true. Conrad Hall won Oscars 3 times, Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, American Beauty, Road to Perdition, He was a great cinematographer, one of the greatest of all time. And I love the fact he didn't even plan on the most famous shot in the whole movie.
And back in the 60s and 67 when the film was made, at this point, a production made a choice to be black and white.
Black and white was dying out in a big way by that point.
Yeah, so they probably wanted to mimic film noir. I think that they were. There was lots of things that called back to that kind of attitude. Certainly that cynicism of film noir and that darkness of film noir. It's interesting that they're black and white because for 67, it was an incredibly modern film. It feels still fresh now. It's aged really well. It still has like a really modern sensibility to it, despite the fact that it's not in color. So the cinematographer makes that choice to make the film bleak and to make it feel, I think, a little more immediate, because black and white would call to mind documentary or television. Kind of the way that video gives us that really immediate feeling of something having verisimilitude. Now, black and white probably would, in the 60s, feel a little more documentary fashion.
It always feels weird to me when a movie's 2:35:1, the true widescreen ratio, and then black and white.
Really?
Yeah, it just doesn't seem right to me. I don't criticize it. I think that's kind of a good thing. It throws you off a little bit. And there weren't that many movies that were the full widescreen, the CinemaScope kind of looking picture, but then also black and white. And yeah, we did watch the Blu-ray, by the way, which looked pretty damn good for a movie of its age.
It's a really great transfer. It's a beautiful movie. The cinematography is fantastic.
Yeah.
And the performances. We haven't really gone off
so the cast. Of the performances. Yeah. The studio wanted Paul Newman and Steve McQueen, but everybody wanted Paul Newman and Steve McQueen, especially Steve McQueen at that point. No big surprise there. They go with the unknowns, or at least lesser knowns. Robert Blake had been in Treasure of the Sierra Madre. He's the kid who sells Humphrey Bogart the lottery ticket.
Which is funny, because they reference Treasure of the Sierra Madre over and over.
Because Perry's favorite movie was that movie.
Isn't that funny?
And they happen to cast the guy who's the kid in that movie.
And it's totally appropriate, because he's obsessed with get-rich-quick schemes. He just thinks that his fortune is out there waiting for him. And just like Treasure of the Sierra Madre, it sure doesn't work out for him.
Bad stuff happens to all of our characters in that one. Well, I guess two of the three at least get out with their lives, and a pretty great lesson is learned by those two guys.
Pretty great story for the rest of their lives.
But Blake was also in Lost Highway, we said that at the top of the podcast, in that incredible role as the mystery man, also a cop in the TV show Beretta. He's dynamite in this film. For whatever he may have done since, that's a pretty good career right there. And this movie, Oscar-worthy, I don't know about that, but I think he's fantastic in the movie. What did you think of him?
I think he kind of makes the film. I mean, there's a lot of things that make the film really wonderful and interesting and dynamic, and I hate to say this about a mer-diddly-erdler, but he's the heart of the film, and he pulls off playing somebody who's both real and sympathetic and has enough evil in him to matter and to make him worthy of the death penalty. And I think a lot of praise is owed to Scott Wilson for giving this really believable portrayal of a charismatic sociopath. Now, we all know Scott Wilson as Herschel from The Walking Dead.
The complete opposite of this guy.
Dramatically different character. Like, if that doesn't exhibit range, I don't know what does. Even if it was the same age playing two parts, I don't think you could possibly recognize him between one and the other. It's a real chameleon performance. And he has just such a tremendous magnetic energy about him. The charisma is everything. He has an amazing screen presence. And so he brings that spark to the film, the counter energy that Robert Blake has. The two of them, they had this tremendous chemistry. I know they were casting, quote-unquote, unknowns, and two people who never were the biggest Hollywood stars. Robert Blake is a household name, probably more because of his murder charges than his actual career. Maybe part of the reason why the film isn't considered as much of a classic is because there's no real stars in it.
Scott Wilson's worked for 50 years and counting. The character is a father. That's a thing that's mentioned a few times, but not dwelled upon too much. It's an interesting little technique that he is fighting for his kids, maybe what he would say, but I don't think he actually does say that in any of his defense arguments, but we don't see that at least. He was in the Heat of the Night the same year. You mentioned The Walking Dead, but here's something I have to recommend, and I think I did this on the In the Heat of the Night podcast. I'll say it again. If you want to see one of the great performances by a bit part in a movie of all time, watch the scene in Monster where he, okay, the movie is 14 years old, dies. Charlize Theron kills him, one of the many people that she kills in the movie. She's great in that scene. He is incredibly great in that scene. You got to see that. I'll try to find a link on YouTube. This guy is a great character actor, and he's never given enough credit for how good he's been. John Forsyth, we haven't talked about him at all. He is the cop who's in charge of this whole thing. He's well played in many versions of this story, including in Capote, the Philip Seymour Hoffman movie that won him the Oscar for Best Actor, and also Infamous. I forget who played him in that. It may have been Sam Neill. I could be wrong about that, but I think it's Chris Cooper in the Capote version. So it's John Forsythe here who plays the cop. Forsythe was in Dynasty and Charlie's Angels on TV. He's Charlie in Charlie's Angels. And he's also the rapist judge in Injustice for All. So he hasn't had the biggest career of all time, but those are some pretty good roles.
I have no complaints about the law side of this film, but it really is super forgettable. Having seen the film a second time now, I had forgotten just about all details of what the cops went through to try to find them. Even thinking about this film for the last few days preparing for the podcast, it was the last thing on my mind. That should be the more dramatic thing.
And we do see them a lot. They've got not as much screen time as Perry and Dick, but fairly close.
And it's not boring. It's just good procedural cop stuff, but when you compare it to something as interesting as Perry and Dick's relationship and their adventures on the lam, it just pales in comparison. Yeah. So I have no complaint about John Forsythe. And you say these actors, they've all had less than impressive careers when you consider their performances in this. Maybe the credit then goes to the writer, producer, director, Richard Brooks, for getting absolutely career-best performances out of all these guys.
Yeah, he was the triple threat in this movie. This guy was prolific. He worked so much. We did Blackboard Jungle last year that he directed, and it was on Turner Classic Movies.
It's less than impressive.
Which had some good stuff in it, but wasn't a great movie. Also, The Professionals, which was just the year before this, a whole different movie, a Western and a badass kind of film. But he was an actor's director. He worked with Paul Newman, Elizabeth Taylor, Burt Lancaster, Lee Marvin, Humphrey Bogart, Yul Brynner. And he does an excellent job of making you like these guys, then pulling the rug out from under you.
Oh, yeah. That's the best thing the film does.
And he's also got that impressive build of tension in the flashback murder scene. We know what happened. And yet there's still a certain amount of tension in this movie. It almost could have been an AFI Top 100 Thrills movie, or at least a nominee for the Thrills list. And that's something else, considering it is based on something that everyone at the time knew about, if they cared to follow Truman Capote's career. Capote, the movie, shows that he was ruined by it. I don't know if that's really true or not. After all we said about Capote's book, maybe I have to try to read it one of these days. We talked about the technical guys, Conrad Hall and Peter Zinner, the cinematographer and editor. They were both great. And then Quincy Jones, and he was Oscar nominated for his music. He did the music in The Heat of the Night and The Color Purple a couple of decades later. Guy's a music legend for more than movies, of course. Everyone knows Quincy Jones's name. What do you think of the score? Because you're not usually a score fan.
I'm not, but it's just so kinetic, intense. It has that amazing energy. It always keeps you on the edge. It gives the movie this eerie aura of dissonance. Do you know what I mean? That jazz is just always on the edge and always keeps you uncomfortable, but it's excellent. I loved it, and like you say, I don't typically love score.
Jazz is the key word. That was an unusual thing while I was getting more into movies around this time period. Maybe it was sometimes in the 50s.
I don't love jazz, but some of the best scores are jazz scores.
I don't remember the In the Heat of the Night score, but was it jazzy? Do you think so?
I can't remember.
No, that movie was very hot, as we are in this room. All right, the influence, we've talked about a bunch of it already. There was a 1996 miniseries with Eric Roberts as Perry and Anthony Edwards as Dick. And I would have liked to have seen that. Seems like a pretty good, interesting comparison. Jonathan Kaplan directed that miniseries. And then Capote and Infamous, they came out around the same time based on this exact storyline, based on what was going on. But they do focus on Truman Capote's adventures in Kansas as he tries to write this book. And then the movie references, they actually mention by name Treasure of the Sierra Madre. And they are natural-born killers. I think that phrase is actually used. And, yes, of course, Quentin Tarantino called his movie Natural-Born Killers. They are more natural-born killers than these two are, because I think that movie's even more violent and more awful.
Oh, yeah. But they're also two killers on the run.
Yeah. Tarantino's always influenced by old movies, and this one probably is one of those then. So the awards in this section, that was nominated for 4 Oscars, didn't win any of them. Best Director for Richard Brooks. He also wrote the screenplay, so he had the double threat going on there. He lost director to Mike Nichols for The Graduate, and then the Conrad Hall cinematography and the Quincy Jones music. The movie was entered into the National Film Registry in 2008. It wasn't the strongest group of all time, but we mentioned a recent one. Deliverance was in that group, and also The Terminator. And the only AFI recognition of any kind is it was 8th in the courtroom category of the top 100 genres, although the courtroom part of this movie is very slight. It's almost entirely about them being caught, and then waiting to die, and then dying. To Kill a Mockingbird was number 1 in the courtroom category of the genres list, and it was nominated for the top 25 music scores and the top 50 villains, both, of course, Dick and Perry.
Oh, and just a note on To Kill a Mockingbird being the number 1 courtroom drama, that was, of course, written by Harper Lee, who is Truman Capote's best friend from childhood. Truman Capote is a proxy character. What's his name? Jem?
It's Jem.
Yeah, is supposed to be Truman Capote. And she went to Kansas with Capote and helped him research the book and interview the subject.
As I show in both Capote and Infamous.
She's played by Sandra Bullock
and Catherine Keener. Yeah. Richard Brooks, we barely said him before we end the podcast. Do you think his direction was good, great, or awesome? It's at least one of those three.
Number one. Yeah, I actually really love the choices he made in this film. I think above all, it's a brave film and it takes chances that work. Still 50 years later, it feels like a unique piece of art.
And I mentioned the guy who won the Oscar that year. And of course, what does that really mean in the end, long term? It is the heat of the moment kind of deal. But it was Mike Nichols for The Graduate, which was a revolutionary movie. And it's one of the all-time biggest hits. We thought the movie was fine. And the direction of that movie is very good. I'm not saying that Brooks should have won over him. It really probably should have been Arthur Penn for Bonnie and Clyde, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going
to go right down to it. But Brooks may have directed this movie better than Nichols directed The Graduate.
I could catch a lot of heat for saying this, but I think that the things that work best about The Graduate are the more conventional elements of it and the parts where he takes chances, with the exception of the ending, which is...
one of the great endings of all time.
One of the great endings of all time, but the parts where he takes chances are the parts of the film that have aged poorly and don't work as well. I've said it many times, that movie's way overrated.
Well, I agree. I've always thought that's very true. But you've got the ending of Bonnie and Clyde. Also, mass murder. These two people get blown away by police officials, and then the movie's just over. Kind of like this movie, where people are murdered, although it's legal murder, and the movie's over.
Yeah, you've got three films that have really exceptional endings, all three of them. Truly impactful, great endings.
And The Heat of the Night and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, about racial relations, also have pretty good endings in their own way.
Yeah, I agree.
Great speech by Spencer Tracy, his last moment on film ever before he died, and he won the Oscar that year. And in The Heat of the Night, it's a mystery film. We finally find out what goes on there. Another well-directed movie by Norman Jewison.
Man, 67 was a good year for film.
But kudos to Richard Brooks. We may not cover his movies ever again, but he's done two we've covered, and this one certainly is the better of the two, In Cold Blood over Blackboard Jungle. But I do recommend The Professionals, and look up his resume. He's got some great titles on there. He was a good workhorse back in this era. Okay, that's it for In Cold Blood. Big thumbs up from both of us. When We Invade Your Lives next week, we'll get away from all this non-lion-related death and get all Hamlet on your ass as we talk about a cartoon juggernaut, The Lion King. The coming attractions trivia for The Lion King. What is your favorite Hamlet adaptation? Laurence Olivier's in 1948, Franco Zeffirelli's with Mel Gibson in 1990, Kenneth Branagh's in 1996, the one with Ethan Hawke in 2000, Hamlet 2 with Steve Coogan, or is it The Lion King?
For the answer to that, please tune into next week's episode. In the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, you can find us on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us on email. Our address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. And while you're there, please rate us, review us. It helps people find us. And also while you're there, please check out any of our number of podcasts on our enormous roster. Over 200 films we've covered, which include all 123 films that made the AFI's 1998 or 2007 list of the best 100 American films ever made. Once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Spark Plug Coffee.
Maybe hot in here, but this was a cinch.
And cut.